Welcome to In Conversation With from Devon Chamber, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Recorded at Fresh Air Studios in Plymouth.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of In Conversation With, the podcast from the Devon Chamber of Commerce, kindly supported by our good friends at Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. My name is Paul Philpott. I'm Vice Chair of the Plymouth Chamber of Commerce and Director of Devon Chamber. Now, we continue our interviews with some of our Devon-based MPs. Now, we've already spoken with Luke Pollard, Caroline Vodan and Steve Darling. Now, this time, we have the pleasure of welcoming to the studio Fred Thomas MP. Hello, Fred.
Hello, very good to be here.
Now, if we were going to create top trumps of MPs in the region, I think you probably score quite a few high points because you've had quite a background, haven't you? It says here to ask you about your journey from Royal Marines, actually now having seen you in the flesh, I think you can kind of tell, he's got big guns, this guy, to being an MP for Plymouth Moorview. Now, what on earth inspired you to go from marineship into MPship?
It was a very swift journey from being a soldier to being a politician and a journey of public service,
Yes. Really.
To be honest, when my friends ask me the question, I often say, God, I don't know what made me go into politics. But actually, when
it's funny because a lot of the other MPs have kind of said that as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to it. Definitely my thinking was guided by wanting to serve our country. I mean, Incredibly patriotic. And I just felt that in my time in the military, I loved the Marines. I love the service, you know, I love the opportunities, the travel, but I increasingly felt that there was more change I could do elsewhere. And ultimately, that's what led me to take the step to say, okay, I want to serve in a different way.
Yeah. So let me ask you then about transferable skills. Have you found that there are certain things that you've learned throughout your time in the Royal Marines that you're now able to deploy throughout your time in Parliament?
Mm.
I mean, obviously, nobody picks an argument with you. That's probably a good thing.
That is actually an interesting one because in the military, there's a very clear hierarchy, very clear structure. And so you know who your boss is and you know who your, to use military language, subordinates are.
Yeah.
And while you might be challenged healthily by your subordinates, ultimately, they will do what you say because it can be an order. Now, that just doesn't exist in politics. Of course, within your own MP setup, Each MP is an employer, you know, a legal employer and employs staff, and that's their own thing. But in terms of actual Westminster, when you're there, it's much murkier. You don't have a job contract. You don't have terms of reference as an MP. If you're in government, then you have a separate ministerial setup. But as a pure member of parliament, it's much less clear. Like, I don't have a boss in pure sense.
Yeah.
I can't be fired in the pure sense. I work for the people of Plymouth Moorview. With my Labour Party hat on, I would say Keir Starmer's my boss. He's the leader of my party and the Prime Minister. So some of the skills are harder to eke out in terms of transferable from military because it is just a different environment. But I do think resilience is massively important in politics and probably why other politicians may have joked on this podcast about, I don't know what made me go into politics, is because it is a bumpy road.
Yeah.
For sure. And you need that personal resilience. You need a thick skin. I mean, the abuse is astonishing and constant from all angles. So you need to be confident that what you're doing is the right thing.
But enough about what happens within Westminster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you need to have kind of courage in your convictions.
Mm.
Like, you've got to be solid in the sense that you are doing the right thing and you know you're doing the right thing. And yes, there's always going to be difficult choices. So there's always going to be two sides to every argument, but you've got to be resilient to kind of carry those things out. And I think the military tries to teach you that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the initial training is based around that. And then the culture, once you're working in the military, even though it may take a dark humour a lot of the time, and I think a lot of people working in various public services, mainly kind of frontline or blue light services, etc., will recognise that, a sort of quite dark humour that gets you through it. But underlying it is a solid conviction that we are doing the right thing and it may not be enjoyable. Probably it's not enjoyable, but it's worth doing.
So what about things like, I know that quite a few members of parliament have done things in their younger years, like participating in debates and things like that. They learned the art of debate so they can stand up. They've able to utilise those skills within the chambers and carry an argument. How do you sit there? Because I guess you don't necessarily have the art of debate, for one other way of putting it, within the military because of exactly what you've just said. So how do you feel when that happens?
I think there are many experiences you can have in your teenage years and your early 20s that shape you very well for Westminster. Being good at debating is not one of them, in my opinion, because actual debate doesn't really happen in Westminster. In the chamber, when a, quote, debate happens, it's nearly always around a proposed government bill. So there's no kind of winner of the debate. The party with the largest majority is going to eventually win the actual vote on the legislation. And every MP going in has basically got a pre-written speech. So you're not really responding to each other's ideas. Mm. You're taking it in turns to bob up and down, stand up and say your bit. Now that's not really debate. You're not really responding. You're not trying to impress a judge or win over a crowd, which is what debate is. But even in the military, actually, you do have debate. I mean, I remember in Marines officer training, we went down to Dartmouth, where the naval officers train. And the idea was to go there so you could get away from the culture of Limpston, which is kind of, as most people in Devon will be aware, very brutal at all times. So you'd go to Dartmouth. So the idea was you kind of focus on being more intellectual and have the academic side of the course. And we did debate classes and people were really good. I remember being really impressed with particularly some of my colleagues in the Marines hadn't gone to university, but were just naturally good debaters. Mm. You get to Parliament, it is a completely different thing. It's just not about being convincing. There's no opportunity to really convince people. With one exception in my 14 months in Parliament, which was the assisted dying debate, which was a private member's bill, as folks will remember, brought by a Labour MP, but it was not a kind of government bill. Mm-hmm. And the government and all the parties, in fact, said, we're not going to whip our MPs. So you can vote what you want on this. So suddenly, for the first time, I understand this is extremely rare, even from colleagues who've been in Parliament for a long time, you were going into the chamber, sitting on the green benches and really having your mind made up. And I was pretty on the fence. And I saw both sides of the argument with assisted dying really clearly. I met tons of community groups in Plymouth. I had loads of conversations with individual residents, charities, on both sides of it. Ultimately, you've got to vote yes or no. So you've got to choose a side to vote. So I was ready to be persuaded, hence why I took so much correspondence and I ran a kind of survey online on my website and everything. And I wanted to kind of represent the people I represent, my constituents' views, and I wanted to understand more about the kind of intricacies of the policy. So in the chamber, I was really listening. I was ready to be swayed. And that was a very unusual experience. I mean, very powerful, because suddenly you are listening to politicians make speeches and you are ready to be swayed. But that's very rare.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about whip, the fact that MPs often get instructed to vote one way or another. I always find that a really interesting concept, because it's like you already mentioned about, you know, representing your constituents. And when an MP, and this is not a critique of any particular party, this is the concept that happens. MPs get whipped and they get told to vote in a certain way. You don't have to give examples, but does that sometimes jar with you? You kind of feel a bit of internal frustration? If so, I can imagine you're probably not the only one.
Yes, is the answer. Yeah. I think if a politician, an MP, came to you and said, I vote with my party whip pretty consistently, and I never, ever think that I have any issue with any of the bills, they'd just be lying.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
any big party, any of the kind of big three parties, you've got enough MPs that's going to represent a range of views. That means you're not going to have a kind of hegemonic, complete view of life. It's just not going to happen. And it would be bad if it did, frankly. It'd be really dangerous if everyone thought the same thing. Instead, you have an internal conversation and the whip is to get things done. Mm-hmm. Because in a democracy, otherwise, in a democracy where you have to have elected representatives voting on legislation, if you didn't have a whip, you wouldn't be able to get an agenda through and we wouldn't be able to drive the country forward. So none of the parties...
And the political system is slow at the best of times anyway, isn't it?
That's democracy. Yeah, you know, that is democracy. Yeah, you know, it would be much quicker. You'd get a lot more things done if you didn't have to worry about that. Mm. And you look at some countries who really don't worry about that, and guess what? They are going really quick. You think of China, they're going really quick. But they don't have to worry about convincing their own MPs to follow the party whip, to vote for something. That's not even on the radar for them. Mm.
You've spoken about attracting manufacturing companies to Plymouth. Like, for example, the day that we're recording this podcast, you've actually come from a manufacturing event. Why are you so passionate about manufacturing in particular? And what sort of future do you see ahead for Plymouth and indeed Devon as a county?
Yeah, you're right. I'm hugely passionate about the manufacturing, the engineering, the innovation that happens in Plymouth. I don't think we talk about it enough. And I see that as a huge part of my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm one of those people who goes from Plymouth to Westminster every week. And I talk about it the whole time. What a fantastic place to do business is, not just in the future, but what's already come from Plymouth. Today's been National Manufacturing Day. And the Plymouth Manufacturing Group have helped organise some visits from Discovery College, from City College, and a couple of other colleges around into manufacturing sites. So I was at Kawasaki today, I was at Alderman's, yesterday I was at Plessy. And I always take my time to go to these wonderful manufacturers and to try and tell the story of the things that happen in Plymouth, the impact we've had on the world. And I talk to the young people about this in schools, in primary schools, colleges in Plymouth, and say, you guys should be really proud of the effect that our city has had on the world, the things that have happened that wouldn't have been able to take place without innovations in Plymouth. And you can be part of it. You can go and work in it. And we know that's important because we know we have a skills challenge in terms of workforce, and we've got more and more work coming to Plymouth, which is potentially great, but it's only great if we can make sure that people living in the travel to work area of Plymouth, let's say, are able to take those jobs up. And we need to have enough people getting the skills very early, STEM skills, whatever it is, getting through to colleges to go and fulfill those jobs. So I see it as a huge part of my agenda as an MP is to go out into schools, colleges, employers, and talk about this a lot. So I spend a huge amount of my time doing that in Plymouth. I also, when I'm in Westminster and I'm around about with the Defence Committee or I'm talking to technology companies, which is another interest of mine in London, I always say to them, and do you know about the Freeport in Plymouth? And are you aware of the fantastic workforce and the opportunities? And we've had some successes with bringing companies to Plymouth, which is really exciting.
I'm picking up underlying tech geek vibes from you. Is that...
Aspiring tech geek. I mean, I am finding that one of the joys of being an MP is that people want to brief you.
Yeah.
And so you have the opportunity to learn. And of course, you shape that yourself because you say no to some things, you say yes to some things. You know, you could triple book yourself every hour, every day as an MP if you just said yes to everything. So I say yes to a lot of the things revolving around tech, engineering, advancing how we do things. And so I've had the opportunity to learn a lot in the last 14 months. And the real joy is when that links back to Plymouth, which is actually increasingly frequent. So yeah, that's kind of an area that I've done a lot of work on.
Yeah, it's really good to try and re-engage the interest in physical things like engineering, because I can only talk with regards to people that I know. And I'm working within the creative services industry myself, but it seems that a lot of individuals are going towards the creative sector for careers. And it seems that engineering, creating, making, developing, and indeed entrepreneurship as well, is getting a bit of a tough ride at the moment with regards to attracting skills and interests from individuals wishing to choose their career path. Would you agree?
I wouldn't know if the actual data would, you'd maybe you know better, would match that. I sense people are still interested in it.
Yeah.
In kind of manufacturing and tech. Just what we have specifically here in this corner of the world is a massively growing demand for it from industry. Some of it driven by the government, the MOD coming to do more business in the dockyard, and some of it coming from companies expanding, just doing more and more business, mainly selling abroad, exporting, and they need to employ more people. When I go around manufacturing companies here, they always say, we're trying to employ more people. But I don't know if people are less interested in entrepreneurship. Sometimes you talk to young people and you get the sense that actually they don't want to work for a massive company. They want to go out and start their own thing. So maybe there's a balance there.
Yeah. And in fact, engaging with SMEs is also listed on my question list, and startups as a passion of yours as well. I was saying to my partner the other day, we were walking home from the studios through the middle of the city centre in Plymouth. And I said to him, you know, you will not recognise Plymouth in 5 years' time. You won't even recognise the county in 5 years' time. There's so much opportunity here. How will you ensure that SMEs know and are equipped to embrace that opportunity?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about trying to knock down regulatory barriers. And some of it is around financing. And I don't think anyone has got all the answers. But the SMEs that I engage with, I sort of fall into two brackets. Some are sort of startups trying to scale up really quickly, probably attracting some private capital, maybe venture capital, private equity, and they want to grow really quickly. And more of those are coming to Plymouth, particularly with our marine autonomy new designation. And then the other type of SME that I engage with quite a lot is sort of more established supply chain SMEs who have been around a bit longer, and they have slightly different challenges. I think the kind of new scale-up startup SMEs, they need a customer. So a lot of them are trying to sell product to the government, be it MOD or DSIT, and they need clarity about what is the government going to want in 5 years' time. So then I talk to government about that. And they also need regulatory change. They can do their testing and their R&D, where a lot of these new technologies, we haven't been able to do this stuff before. So the kind of framework for what is and isn't allowed, whether it's in the air, on the sea, under the sea, whether it's to do with data, kind of doesn't exist. So they're at a loggerhead, and that needs unlocking. And then with the supply chain SMEs, they also need stability. And that's really hard. They need to know, ideally, what their order book is going to look like next year, because you need to start thinking about recruitment. And that's really, really challenging. I mean, you read stories today. I don't know of any in Plymouth, but a number of SMEs who were supplying some of the companies that have been hacked recently. And they've basically just been ruined. So the government's potentially stepping in. I don't actually know the details of it, but I read that the government may be stepping in to kind of help these companies exist, because their order book's so short, you know, 6, 8, 10 weeks. And if it just falls off, suddenly there's no income.
Our supply chain is particularly fragile, I think, European-wide, not just in the United Kingdom, but across the greater region. And there are a lot of challenges that are placed upon, not just regulation. It's both an equally exciting and also equally scary time to be in business, especially if you're an SME and especially if you're a micro business or indeed just starting out. What advice would you give to entrepreneurs and business leaders with regards to navigating the current landscape?
Look, I'm super aware I've never run a business. I've never started a business. So I'm really impressed by everyone who does. You know, you commonly read in business books that you've got to be prepared to fail. I'm sure that's right. I'm sure you do need to be prepared to fail.
Always, come back, I think.
But no, I'm really impressed by people who have, I think it does take a bit of bravery, doesn't it? It takes a bit of courage and self-belief because you're taking a huge amount of responsibility. The minute you start employing people, you obviously, I imagine, feel very responsible for those people. And then that adds to another stress of, yeah, I want my company to do well, but I also want it to do well so I can look after my people and so I can grow. And then you think about adding to the community. So I'm blown away by SMEs and startups and keen to support them when I can.
That's good. It's really good that you are there to support people who are both running businesses, but also individuals who have special educational needs and disabilities. The abbreviation is SEND. And you're bringing your love of sport to that support, aren't you?
Well, I'm trying to. I mean, it was one of the areas that I learned about. Having finished my Marine service in sort of mid-2023, I had about a year as a candidate before getting elected, before the election was called. And I spent that year largely knocking doors and talking to people and visiting schools and understanding the communities. And that's when I learned about the really rising number of particularly young people coming through with some form of need. So I became really interested in this and I still am really interested. I learn a lot about it. I talk to head teachers and, you know, all sorts of people about it the whole time. Even today I was talking to people about it, trying to understand what is going on in our society. And combine that with my love of sport. I grew up fortunately physically able to play lots of sport, played a ton of football, boxed a lot in the Marines. And I really think it's a valuable way of bringing people together. And it seems from talking to the professionals, from teachers and people in healthcare, that some of the young people coming through have got some form of need that maybe isn't a, what you might call a kind of special educational need. It might not be a disability, but it is some form of extra need. And that potentially we can kind of help them through this with improved team skills, collaboration, getting them out about interacting. And for me, that means sport. So I think there's a kind of really potentially powerful thing we can do as a society to help even younger people focus, get them away from their screens, away from the tech. And I do wonder if maybe the tech and the screens happens to coincide with this massive rise in young people coming through with increased need. I don't think that's a coincidence, but I don't have the data for it, but that's my sense. So that's what's led to me.
I think there's nothing wrong with having a bit of intuition about something. You know, even if you said twice about not having the data for something, but we're too quick to criticize somebody or critique someone for just having a hunch or for genuinely having a feeling and belief. And if you've got that feeling and belief, then I think that's good enough for me.
Very good. I will tell you, there are some people for whom that is not good enough. And they will come back and say, how can you prove this?
Yeah.
But, you know, that happens in life. But I appreciate you saying that. And as you rightly say, it is my hunch that the massive increase in tech and people sort of using it under the age of 8, under the age of 10, has got some link to when people are then 12, 14, a massive explosion in young people not being able to deal with the kind of situations that even as little as 10 years ago, but certainly 20, 30 years ago, they would have been able to deal with.
Well, earlier this morning, I walked through the University of Plymouth on my way to the studios and I'm sure we've all done this. I'm not making fun of someone. We've all done something similar to this. But the young person who was following on behind me was very much glued to their phone and exited the Levinsky building because I'd take a naughty shortcut right through the actual building. And as you come out the other side, you've got these long steps. Well, they allowed the door to open, but they completely were on their phone and ignored the steps. And I just saw the stumble down the top three steps.
Oh, no. That's one way to learn, isn't it?
Yeah. Look ahead. Look down, look ahead, and also look up.
The Devon Business Show is back. Devon Chamber is bringing the Southwest's largest business event back to Plymouth Life Centre on Wednesday, the 15th of October, connecting hundreds of businesses and entrepreneurs with future clients all under one roof. With over 125 exhibitors, interactive stands, live podcasts, a networking hub, and guests from across the city and the county, this is the not-to-be-missed date for your diaries. There are many ways to get involved, including a launch party on the 1st of July, where you can enjoy a cocktail and canapés at Tinside Lido overlooking the Sound, plus our pre-show networking breakfast at Home Park's Mayflower Grandstand on the day. A limited number of stands are available. Book yours now at devonchamber.co.uk the Devon Business Show at Plymouth Life Centre on Wednesday the 15th of October. Let's get working at networking.
Derriford Hospital A&D Department, you've worked hard towards improving that. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, look, that's been really positive. So this was quite early on in my time as MP, but I was working on it before getting elected as well. And Boris Johnson announced a few years ago, I think it was 2021, around that time, a very great sounding scheme called the New Hospital Programme.
Mm-hmm.
And he announced that around 40 hospitals around the country were going to get this huge funding to build, quote, a new hospital. It just so happened that all of these hospitals, all 40 of them, happened to be in seats that his party at the time held, but were worried about losing. Bear in mind, there's sort of over 200 hospitals, maybe, I don't know, somewhere around mid-200s across the country. He chose 40 in seats they were worried about losing. So some would suggest that might be a kind of tactical decision. They're signing tons of money here, and the local MPs went out and announced it all around the country. You know, I've got money for the local hospital. Election comes round, we get into power. Turns out Boris Johnson didn't actually assign any money to any of these programmes. So really hard decision for incoming health secretary. He's got to decide how he's going to deal with the situation. Communities have been told around the country, you're getting a, quote, new hospital. And he's either got to find tens of billions of pounds to do it, which hadn't been assigned by the previous government, or he's got to decide how to sequence this in a way that's manageable. So this then led to lots of conversations in Parliament with mainly new MPs, because all 40 of these hospitals, Johnson's party lost and became new government-held seats, including mine in Plymouth Morview with Derriford. So I was having conversations with Wes, and basically, this is where you need to make the point that actually we need to be really high up the priority list. And the way the government eventually decided to do it after a few months was to have different waves. So they haven't cancelled any of it, but they have different waves. And I was able to secure Derriford to be in wave one, which, as it sounds, the money's coming straight away and actually they've started building it already. So that was a kind of real early win for me, and an education in how you go about influencing government to get the win for your community and for your patch. And like, there's lots of different ways of doing it. You can stand up in the chamber and you can make lots of points, and you can go on the media and write letters and tweet about the letters. Everyone sees it in quite a public way. Or you can do it in quite a private way and request a one-to-one meeting, or just grab the Secretary of State in the voting lobbies. And there's different ways. And kind of that was a good learning experience for me about how to get things done.
Yeah. So all things being equal, regardless of which political party is in power or indeed incumbent, there will always be that game of chess that is played with regards to manoeuvring assistance towards areas that may or may not be carrying a higher degree of voting favour. But you're saying that even if you're a local politician, you still actually have to battle against your own party to bring something to a region. It's not like an immediate yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience, is that there are so many constituencies.
Yeah.
There's 650 MPs, and whoever's in power has got the majority, clearly. In this instance, the government has got, well, I don't know, we keep booting people out. What are we on? 410 now, something like that. That's 410 good MPs around the country who want to make sure they're getting the right thing for their community. So yeah, it's competitive. Of course it's competitive. And people go about it in different ways with different successes. But yeah, for sure, it's not a kind of straightforward, oh, I'm a governing party MP, I'm going to get everything. It's not the case. You've got to work hard.
Interestingly here, it says that you speak Arabic, which I would never have guessed, because you worked as a journalist in Cairo. You got a bit of a media.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Yes?
This is before I joined the Marines. So as part of my undergrad, I studied Arabic.
Yeah.
So I spent about 6 months at a language school in Cairo during my undergrad. Yeah.
Ishmi, Paul?
Ismi.
Ismi.
Ismi, yeah. Very good. Okay. We can have this conversation in Arabic.
No. That's it.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Ismi, my name is.
No, that was Geremina Mahoga. That's something like a million thank you, a thousand thank you.
I don't recognise that.
No, that's not Arabic. Yeah,
So I spent time in Cairo. And then when I graduated, I knew I wanted to join the Marines after a year. There's only one intake a year for Marines after training. So I had September to September. So I went back to Cairo. And from my time as a language student there, I knew you could get a job pretty easily in the kind of media world there if you spoke good English. And so I did that and quickly started writing for a business magazine and had a really fantastic 12 months there. And yeah, at the end, my Arabic was pretty good. It's pretty terrible now, unfortunately. Joined the Marines after that, never used my Arabic.
It's difficult, isn't it? I've got one of those brains that really cannot pick up languages, and I'm trying desperately to learn another language. My partner learned a bit of Arabic, randomly so. It's crazy. Not even the writing's the same. It's like, is it, what's the character set called? It's
Yeah, I found it okay.
I think that's actually called Arabic as well. It's not Cyrillic, it's Arabic, yeah.
Yeah, the Arabic script.
It's not Roman-based, you know, standard letters for those.
No, it's a different alphabet. I was okay at languages, to be honest. I mean, my French and German is okay. Once you learn the alphabet with Arabic, which isn't that hard, it takes like a few days. Once you learn all the letters, then you kind of start breaking it down and you can start writing down the words and you start learning the kind of roots of words. It doesn't take that long to kind of feel like you're on a journey of learning. It's still a really hard language, but it's not completely impenetrable. I've heard that some, like Mandarin, apparently, some people just struggle because it's based around tones. Apparently, some people just really can't get it at all. I've never tried.
Yeah.
Arabic, I think, is not that inaccessible once you learn the alphabet.
Yeah. You're very skilled to do that. So talk about skills, actually. Skills is another subject that you picked up earlier in this conversation, but you've been specifically working towards improving the outlook for younger people on the skills front. We say there's a skills crisis or the skills agenda. What are your views with regards to the overall topic of skills and how we're treating it?
Yeah, and I know this will be of interest for loads of your listeners as well. I do think there are really promising steps being taken, both by national government and sort of in partnerships. And I'm obviously more familiar with Plymouth than wider Devon, but there is fantastic work going on in Plymouth around skills. But it's part of a bigger conversation, which we've alluded to during this podcast a couple of times, around what is the outlook for young people? What are the challenges for young people coming through? And what are people motivated to do? And I think a really positive move of late has been, as part of the government reshuffle a couple of weeks ago, while Pat McFadden has gone in to be Secretary of State for the Department of Work and Pensions, they've also taken the decision to move skills and the skills agenda out from the Department of Education and put it in there and put it in work and pensions. Because I think it's something about how we enable people to contribute to our society and to have the kind of dignity of a good job and work. And so some of that is about lifting people up out of a situation where otherwise they might not be able to or feel able to work. And some of it is about empowering those who are already going to do okay in life, but push them that further to give even more. So I'm always on the lookout for good initiatives locally. And when I talk to businesses, I always say to them, what are you doing to get into schools, to talk to young people? Because the amount of conversations I've had with businesses of all types who say, I'm worried about workforce, I'm worried about people coming through and skills. And I say, well, what are you doing about it? And they say, well, it's very difficult to get into schools. They've got a tight syllabus. They're only giving us a couple of hours. If we spend a day going to school, we're hitting our own bottom line because it's a day we're cutting our own output somewhat. But if people are talking about the threat of a skills shortage as being a kind of existential one, if it's that serious, then I think industry has got to take a corresponding action, which would be to kind of really actively go and talk to young people and show them the opportunities. So I always encourage people to do that.
I would agree. I think it's industry and every sector's responsibility to try and attract new skills and new talent and encourage, you know, the next generation, because not only businesses, but industries need succession planning. Where do the new presenters for podcasting come from?
Oh, where are they? They're on TikTok, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but, you know, then there's the whole question about how you monetize it properly and strategize it. And in fact, I want to ask our listeners to search for a podcast which is presented by Jackie Grubb, who's the CEO of City College Plymouth, called Skillfully Speaking. It's just about to start its third season.
Oh, brilliant.
And she speaks to entrepreneurs and, you know, a small collection of celebrities about skills. And the discussion isn't, oh, when did you do your degree? What you like with mathematics? It's not the traditional conversation about skills. It's about getting under the hood of individuals about how they transferred skills from, you know, being a runner to working for charities and all these kind of things. And I think it's something you've obviously done, because we spoke earlier about your transition from being in the Marines to being an MP. So it's not right for us to put an individual into a certain box, either personality-wise, personally-wise, or even for their career, because everybody has kind of untapped talent.
I think that's right. And you often hear that generations coming through are going to have multiple different careers. And so it's that piece around resilience, confidence, aspiration. And those are the kind of qualities I think we need to be focusing on in early years and all through school, and probably get away from this focus on syllabus, Ofsted rating. I won't say their name because I didn't ask them about saying it publicly, but I spoke to one head teacher in a Plymouth school this week, and they were saying they were really focusing on resilience off their own back, not being asked to by any kind of government or local bodies, but just they've observed that that's one of the skills that they really want their young children and their people coming through to have. And so they're trying to change their syllabus to include more activities that lead to that. So, for example, taking children out of the classroom at a much younger age than used to happen.
Yeah.
Because maybe they're not getting those experiences at home in a way that they would have 10, 20 years ago. And I'm totally for that.
It seems the syllabus concept in the educational system is a bit slow to adapt. Mm. Or rather, is that a fair comment? I don't know if it is. Because maybe previously it was adapting fast enough, but the world we're in is just blazing ahead at lightning speed with innovation, new technologies. Mm. And by the time you've got something into the syllabus and it becomes a topic to teach, it's already out of date.
Yeah, it is a really hard area of policy. It's not one that I've worked closely on in my 14 months in Parliament, but I can imagine how much consultation you'd want to do before you change a national syllabus. And like with so many things, there's going to be strong arguments on either side. Mm. Immensely difficult for policy to catch up with how fast tech is moving. I do have the strong sense now that we are in a situation where we have not properly gripped the potential harms that tech is doing to young people. And as we've said, I'm a huge advocate for technology in so many ways, but that doesn't mean that we should be inflicting it or letting it run wild amongst young people without properly understanding and doing studies on what effect it really has, which I don't think Western society has really done yet. And it may well be one of those things we look at in kind of 30 years' time when proper regulations are brought in and think, wow, it really was the Wild West a few years ago in the 2020s when we were just letting people do X, Y, Z and kind of destroy their brains. And no wonder they then struggled when they became adults.
Mm. You're both an MP, obviously, and a reservist, which must keep you rather busy. So when you're not doing all that, how do you find time and what do you do to kind of chillax and get rid of the frustrations that you no doubt experience up in Westminster?
I think I'm getting better and learning how to kind of carve out time for myself.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, weekend just gone, I managed to take a couple of days and went up north to Northumberland with my dad and my brother. And we just took some time walking. And I pretty much managed to kind of not look at my phone for 2 or 3 days, well, in the evenings, but I wasn't kind of on my phone, which is almost the first time since being elected I've had that kind of headspace. So it is a huge challenge because it is completely relentless. But it's also kind of like, how long is a piece of string, this being an MP and the other kind of responsibilities? And you, of course, need to do it sustainably. You have to make time. But like I was saying at the beginning, I don't really have a boss, so to speak. Therefore, it's up to me. I'm learning that also from more experienced MPs or people who were MPs and now retired.
Well, you say you don't have a boss, but you've probably got several thousand bosses that vote for you.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's
you know, when people say to you, you run your own business, you must be great being your own boss. It's like, well, actually, every client is your boss in a way. It's different.
Yeah, but I think you've just got to be sensible because I want to do a good job for people I represent. And if I'm just moving at a million miles an hour and taking loads of meetings every day and working every weekend, which I was doing the first kind of 8 to 10 months, I realised I was offering very little in those meetings because you're so tired and you're just getting through the day from kind of one thing to the next thing. Whereas in fact, I think it's probably better and you're doing a better job for the people you work for if you've got more energy, you've got more concentration, and you're able to step back and figure out ways of solving problems as opposed to simply seeing them and kind of being in every single meeting. So yeah, part of it's about kind of building out time for yourself so you can have your own life. But part of it is also, I think it makes you better at your job.
Yeah, but I can imagine those early days, you're probably running pretty much on adrenaline and kind of like the excitement of it all. Not that the excitement is any less, but when you've got something new, it's like, you know, 24-7, I'm going to get this done, get this done, get this done. And then I guess a bit of reality kind of kicks in.
Yeah, I think speaking to a lot of my intake from July 2024 election, for a lot of people, it was Christmas was the first slowdown because we were elected. We had about 3 weeks in Parliament during July. Then it was August recess, but I don't think any of us felt we could take time off.
Yeah.
So all of us were back to our constituencies, desperately trying to set things up. So last August 2024, I was running around Plymouth trying to recruit my staff, trying to hire a constituency office, trying to set up meetings, moving at a million miles an hour. What I should have done was just chill out for a couple of weeks because I was knackered from the campaign anyway. But I think it was a mistake everyone made, all the new intake of MPs. And then you're back to Parliament, September, conference season, October, November, December. At Christmas, I think people slowed down. And actually, there was a palpable different atmosphere in Parliament in January and February this year, where people were kind of more human. And you're actually able to sit down for a second and learn who people are and catch your breath.
Yeah, I think it was Caroline Vodon who shared in a previous interview about the fun of the onboarding experience at Westminster. It's a bit crazy. Everybody doesn't know where they're going. It's just like your first day at school.
I think it was really poorly delivered, personally.
Oh, really?
I've shared that with the Speaker of the House. Yeah, because people are so tired.
Yeah.
Everyone's just been campaigning for at least 8 weeks, so two straight months of every single day out knocking doors. If you're a candidate yourself running for election, there's a lot of media interest, and that's extremely stressful, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. if you're not used to it. Then you come in and they just threw this very, very compact, very full-on 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. So you've got no other time to do anything else. Mm-hmm. Onboarding induction package at us, which was just not fit for purpose. And it left so many problems because, of course, you're not in a good state to take all that information in. And then 3 months down the line, you suddenly realize, I don't know how to do X, Y, Z, fill in whatever form it is online because I've got a new employee or whatever it is. There's so many different aspects on there. I think it'd be much better, personally, if after an election, there was at least a week where the previous MP who's lost is still the MP. Or you just have a fallow week where you say, look, for 1 week, there's no representation for a week. Give people a chance to catch their breath, do those induction briefings without already having the responsibility of being the MP. Because day one, your email address is set up. I had something like 2,000 emails in the first 3 days, and you haven't employed staff by that stage, because how could you have? So I really think it was not fit for purpose. I'm glad Caroline could find some humour in it.
But it is actually, if you think about it, it's a bit mental, isn't it?
It's poor.
Because
it's really poor.
You're literally, in terms of the job, you're out if you're currently in, and then the next day the new person's in. So is there any kind of handover?
No, absolutely not.
That's lunacy.
No, and if you even think of the kind of basic casework that MPs deal with, previous MP would have had open cases that they would have been helping someone with.
Of course,
but GDPR rules would mean they can't just transfer it to you.
Which is kind of unfair, because there's nothing to say you wouldn't have picked it up, especially in your constituency.
Of course.
If somebody's got a pain point, you're there to help.
100%. But there is no technical handover. Yeah, I think it's a really poor process.
Madness. Hopefully that will improve. You've made headlines by standing up in the House of Commons and declaring Plymouth's beer as the best in the UK.
Well, I didn't know what you were going to say there.
These are challenging questions here. So if we set beer aside for a moment, what's the one thing you say every visitor to Plymouth absolutely has to try?
Every visitor to Plymouth, I think, have a dip.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quite a unique thing we've got. There's very few places where you have a city as developed as ours, with as many kind of different educational, business, cultural experiences available, that is also got beaches. That's pretty rare, I think. It's funny, across the world, but certainly across the UK.
Yeah.
So I always say to people, make sure you get up early in the morning, go down and have a dip. And I think that helps people sort of fall in love with the city when they're just visiting.
Yeah. But you're not going to get me doing any of that crazy wild.
No, you're not going in there?
No. I prefer the warmth far too much. Fred Thomas MP, thank you very much for joining us. And I'm sure everybody across the political spectrum wish you the very best.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
In Conversation With is supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors, helping with all your business and personal taxation needs. Westcott's, we're here. Produced by Fresh Air Studios, full audio and video production services for business podcasts and corporate events. Visit freshairstudios.com. Produced by Paul Philpott. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video production by Mark Stevenson. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Copyright Devon Chamber and Fresh Air Studios Limited. All rights reserved.